All right, you guys, welcome back. I mean, from yesterday, you know, to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Just getting it together here. Let's see. Great. So, 25 from now. Okay, good deal. All right, so today's show, got a good show lined up for you today. I screwed up, man. I'm sorry. Jim, if you're listening out there, I'm sorry. I arranged an interview with Jim Ostrowski, and then I didn't get the book read in time. And I know I probably won't be able to finish the whole book before tomorrow. I only bumped him one day, but I meant to have at least skimmed through the damn thing before I bring him on the show, and I realized way too late this morning that it's way too late for me to dive into this thing. So Jim Ostrowski has been officially bumped until tomorrow. Sorry about that, Jim, but we'll have him back very soon. Okay, but in his place, we'll have Nancy Yosef, now at the Daily Beast, formerly with McClatchy Newspapers. Friend of the show. Fan of the show. Believe that. U.S. warplanes are helping Iran win. Iran and America are still enemies, technically, but U.S. air power has ISIS pinned down in Iraq, and that's helping Iran move in. Oh, yeah. So that's Nancy Yosef reporting for the Daily Beast about Barack Obama, like George W. Bush before him, acting as the servant of the Ayatollah in Iran. It's amazing, these guys, isn't it? It's amazing. Ooh, I got more amazing, too. I don't know. Garrus makes it work every time. Do you guys have trouble with the Wall Street Journal paywall? I mean, the trick is you put the title into Google News, and then you use the Google News link, and it ought to show it to you. But for some reason, a lot of times, I can't get the Google News link. All I get is the plain old damn Wall Street Journal link, even after I clean my cookies and cash out and everything. But anyway, it works for Garrus every time I send him a title. He sends me back a correct link, a usable link to a Wall Street Journal story. And this one is, Al-Qaeda, a lesser evil? Syria war pulls U.S., Israel apart. Actually, Syria war pulls U.S. toward high treason, because that's what Israel wants. Hey, it wasn't their towers that got knocked down. What do they care about Al-Qaeda? The only thing notable about Al-Qaeda to the government of Israel is that, oh, good, as Benjamin Netanyahu said on the day of the September 11th attack, this will be good for us, good for Israel. And as he said a few years later, we are benefiting from the attack on the Twin Towers and the American struggle in Iraq, right? Not we're benefiting from the destruction of Iraq, because, oops, seems like Iran and Osama are the primary beneficiaries of that one. Oh, but the American struggle in Iraq? Oh, yeah, Israel's benefiting from that. You see, when Americans are dying violently, then it's easier to lie to their parents about who's doing it and why. Oh, the terrorists are doing it because they believe in Islam, and so now the occupation of the West Bank is justified. Get it? Waka, waka, waka. All of Israel's enemies are your enemies. Because you're stupid, and you let the Israelis tell you things, and then you believe them. Hey, that's a real quote. Go look it up. It's in Haaretz. Multiple witnesses. Not we're struggling from the end of the Saddam, or not we're benefiting from the end of the Saddam Hussein regime. We're benefiting from the American struggle in Iraq, he said. That would have been 2005, I think. The current prime minister of Israel. Oh, yes. Well, all their enemies happen to be Muslims. Oh, except for the Christians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem that they would just have you ignore right out of existence. But most of their enemies are Muslims, of all different descriptions, but so, okay, that's fine. All the better reason for them to conflate all of their enemies with yours. When Israel, of course, is the reason you have all the enemies in all your enemies in the first place. If it wasn't for American support for Israel, Mohammed Atta would have never crashed that plane into the North Tower in the first, or the South Tower in the first place. Anyway, Dar Jamail is going to be on the show as well. He's going to be talking about American militarism and its effect on the environment here. And no, it's not going to be a bunch of crap about global warming. It's about real pollution, real destruction of Americans' habitat by our so-called protectors in the Pentagon. Dar Jamail. Hey, if you were Dar Jamail, you might have switched from covering war to covering the environment too. Me too. Poor guy's probably shell-shocked as all hell. Lucky he's doing journalism at all. We're lucky his journalism has anything to do with militarism at all. At this point. What Dar Jamail has been through covering the wars. But anyway, so this is a good one, man. We ran it the other day on antiwar.com, and we'll have him on the show to talk about it today. And then our friend Grant F. Smith will be here as well. Speaking of Israel, Grant F. Smith will be here to talk about a new shindig that they're throwing there in Washington, D.C. to educate people about the power of the Israel lobby in the United States. Like we were talking about with Phil Giraldi yesterday, according to Steve Rosen, the guilty of espionage former head of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Israel lobby is like a night flower. It thrives in the darkness and shrivels in the light. So, hey, there you go. That's all you got to do. Tell the truth about AIPAC to the people and see how they like it. Not very much. And it isn't just AIPAC. It's the rest of the lobby, too. But anyway, so that's what Grant F. Smith is doing over there at the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. And really, what he focuses on is the Israeli government's crimes inside this country. Not their, you know, pushing it when it comes to lobbying power, but breaking the law. Primarily when it, you know, in terms of espionage, stealing American documents, and then helping twist American policies based on their secret information. Remember when Steve Rosen was indicted for espionage and Obama ended up letting him off the hook? Well, the judge basically gave him no choice by that point. But whenever he was indicted for espionage, what was going on was the Israeli spies had their stooge Larry Franklin abscond from his Pentagon office with documents detailing the highest level discussions in the Bush White House about what is to be done with Iran. So here's documents portraying, you know, I don't know if Bush, if it's Bush, but at least Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor at the time, and other members of the National Security Council and the War Cabinet discussing Iran. And the Israelis wanted to know very badly what it was that they're saying. How best to lie us into war. That's what they're all about. So, kind of a negative influence on American foreign policy, which is already a problem. You know, I just rejected an article the other day for antiwar.com that basically told the story that everything was fine until Israel screwed everything up for America. Yeah, America was a limited Jeffersonian constitutional republic until the advent of the Israel lobby. Yeah, well, I got news for you. Nuh-uh. The American empire is already a horrible mess. That's why the Israelis work so hard on bending it to their will. It's already in their region. And so it's the same reason that virtually every government in the world who can afford to at least tries to influence American foreign policy, for good or for ill. Because our government makes their lives our business. Anyway, Rand Paul on the Kurds and more bad news when we get back from this break. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me. The social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Like I say, Nancy Youssef will be here in just a minute. Talk about this new one in the Daily Beast about Iran and Iraq. America as the Iranian Air Force again. Dar Jamail and Grant F. Smith also will be on the show. So, now's the part where I complain about Rand Paul again. Oh, God. Here's the thing about Rand. Right after I was done slamming him on the show yesterday, this story came out that, Rand Paul wants to promise, his words, wants to promise an independent Kurdish state to the Kurds. And I guess, was it the Israelis who told him to say this? Does anyone know why Rand Paul says anything? He wants to promise it to them, huh? Which I guess means he's willing to go to war against the Shiite Iraqi government, the government of Iran, the government of Turkey, and for that matter, the governments of Armenia and Azerbaijan as well. In order to secure a new independent Kurdish state, huh? A landlocked Kurdish state that right now is made out of five or six different states. And what the hell is wrong with this guy? That makes him the dumbest senator out of all the senators, at least on the issue of Kurdistan. And it makes him as dumb as McCain, just generally speaking. Is there no one? I wonder, Rand, the way he operates in his office, is it like George Lucas, where he only has yes men? He doesn't have the courage to have a single advisor who will contradict him about anything? But sir, have you ever looked at a map of Kurdistan? The region Kurdistan? How in the hell is America supposed to guarantee its independence without starting four wars, you idiot? Right now, the Turkish Kurds have a modus vivendi kind of a thing going on. It's not perfect, but the war of, which was really a war of the Turkish government against the Kurds, who have far less power to wage war back, has finally ended. And Bill Clinton helped the Turks kill Kurds by the tens of thousands back in the 1990s. And now they have a kind of a semi-autonomy type of a situation. The government has ceased pretending that Kurdish is a subsidiary of their own language. And are now finally at least admitting a separate ethnicity on the part of the Kurds, and are recognizing their pseudo, sorta, de facto independence. Rand Paul would blow all that up, huh? And for what? For what? Is this one person got his ear and said, hey, Rand, you know it'd be a good idea, Kurdish independence? Well, that's funny, because right now, the U.S. government is doing everything they can to convince the Kurds to back off independence and to stick with their alliance with Baghdad in the name of fighting the Islamic State, at least supposedly, in the name of preventing a war between Shiistan and Kurdistan. And it's already wrong. It's already madness, really, for Rand to talk about how, oh, yeah, America needs to, sell more weapons to the Kurds. Oh, we need to arm up the Kurds and arm up the Kurds and arm up the Kurds and keep on arming them up. And if those weapons fall in the hands of the PKK or PJAC or any other group of communist terrorist Kurds, well, whatever. We'll deal with that crisis when that happens, right? And here, he used the word promise. I would promise an independent state to the Kurds and draw new lines, he said. Draw new lines. This is Ron Paul's son. Fresh from signing the sabotage letter trying to destroy the nuclear deal with Iran, which he then turned around and lied about. Oh, the sabotage letter? Well, I only signed that because I was trying to strengthen the hand of the president in the negotiations. What is he doing? What idiot is up there telling Rand Paul what to do? He throws his own self under the bus by signing that letter. Why? For 2 years has he resisted signing additional, he did support and voted for sanctions back in 2012, but in 2013 and 14, well, or maybe skip 13, in 14 and 15, he has opposed new sanctions that he said would ruin the negotiations. Then he signs the ruin the negotiations letter. Dear Iran, don't bother negotiating with the United States. Our word is worth nothing, the letter said. And then he comes right out and he lies about it and says, I only did that to strengthen the president's hand. Well, who is he helping by doing that? He cost himself the support of Justin Raimondo and whatever last few libertarians ever supported him. Boy, if you lost Justin, Rand, you're really screwing up, dude. Because he was willing to tell any lie to himself to justify his support for you up until yesterday. And then he turns right around. He pulls the rug out from under his own self for pulling the rug out from under his own self. Oh, the sabotage Iran talks letter? I only signed that because I'm trying to help Obama. So now he ends up hurting himself with Adelson and Netanyahu and everybody he was trying to suck up to the day before yesterday again. Why? If you're going to go ahead and throw yourself on the mercy of a foreign power on the 0.1% chance of having a little bit better opportunity to get more personal power to satisfy your own personal ambition, then why sabotage yourself 1 minute later? Why go on the Today Show yesterday morning and lie right to all of our faces about your purpose for signing the letter and in a way that only undermines the real reason that we all know you signed the damn letter? Idiot! And then as soon as he's done with this, he comes out and he says, if I was the president, I would draw entirely new lines around the region of Kurdistan and I would promise them an independent state and go to war for it? Go to war with our NATO ally Turkey for it? Go to war with Iran for it? What is he talking about? Who is telling Rand Paul what he thinks and what to say? And who, in even the people working for him who mean well and who are rolling their eyes and are begrudging this kind of thing, are you not advising him to just be principled? It's easier. All this dishonesty, it's too hard to keep up with what position you're taking on any given day, guys. Trying to help Obama is why he signed the letter. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Nancy Youssef, now at the Daily Beast. Welcome back to the show, Nancy. How are you doing?
Great to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. The article is called U.S. Warplanes Are Helping Iran Win. Well, no doubt about that, I don't guess. But helping them win what? Where? Right now?
Well, right now, the Iraqi forces who have Iranian advisors and Iraqi militias who also have Iranian advisors are in the Sunni city of Tikrit, which we know in this country most of all is Saddam Hussein's hometown, and they are battling the Islamic State forces there. And one of the reasons the Islamic State has not been able to fend off the roughly 23,000 troops that are confronting them is that they can't move large numbers of troops, and they can't move large numbers of troops because of the U.S. air campaign, which has made it all but impossible for them to move any sort of large formations throughout the country. And so the sort of second-order effect, if you will, of the U.S. air campaign is to help Iranian-backed forces and militias potentially take back the Sunni city from the Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. And now, I guess initial reports, at least out of Tikrit, were that the Shiite militias and the Iranians were going ahead. They didn't even tell the Americans about it, and they weren't asking for any air support once they did find out about it. Is that still correct? The Americans aren't directly helping with this particular battle, but you're just saying they're keeping ISIS at bay all across the rest of the country.
That's exactly right. And the U.S. was not told. General Lloyd Austin, who's the head of U.S. Central Command, said they learned about it through drones, surveillance, if you will, that the offensive was happening. And remember that there have been reports that the Iranian forces have their own air facilities or air resources and are able to do their own strikes and surveillance as well. So there is nothing to indicate that the U.S. has been doing anything directly to help in the Tikrit campaign.
Right. And now, when you talk about their air power, are those just 1970s model F-14s, or they have other planes that they've gotten from the Russians?
They have a few others, actually, that are a little bit more up-to-date, and it's all sort of unconfirmed, presumed, but not confirmed, at least out of the Pentagon, where I'm calling you from.
Right. All right. Now, wouldn't that be funny to see, you know, American and Iranian Navy planes fighting together, bombing the same targets together? So what you're really getting to here is it seems to me like maybe even in Washington, D.C., because of the jargon that's used, that some confusion is being caused by a refusal of the American side to be honest about what it is that they're dealing with. For example, when they say Iraqi forces, what they mean is Iranian-backed Shiite militias and what's left of the Iraqi army, which is an Iranian-backed Shiite militia. If they want to talk about Iraqis in terms of civilians, well, that includes all kinds of Shia, Sunni, and Kurds. But there is no Iraqi forces. The forces are already completely split along sectarian lines, correct?
Well, that was a result of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who got rid of Sunni generals and whatnot. What I find interesting in all of this is how complex Iraq has made relations in that region, that it's led to strange bedfellows, and that the reality is that to defeat the Islamic State, it turns out it's going to have to be a sort of unspoken but joint U.S.-Iranian effort, that the U.S. can provide the superior air power and has said it's not going to provide ground forces, and that's being supplemented by Iran. The problem becomes long-term, what are the effects? Because if the U.S. is seen as supporting Shia, and those Shia militias then victorious carry out ethnic cleansing or sectarian violence against Sunnis, is the U.S. seen as complicit? That is, what is the Iraq that emerges if these militias are victorious in defeating the Islamic State? What's left behind? And who's going to make sure that it is as inclusive as the U.S. has called for?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what I mean about the jargon there about, you know, if you go back 10 years, they said, well, we're fighting for the Iraqi people against the terrorists, when in fact they were fighting for the Shiite militias against the Sunni militias and helping kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and helping create the groundwork, create the reasons why people would rally to the Islamic State or then Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the first place. And it seems like that's the same kind of danger that they're going under now. If they are really convincing themselves that these are, quote, Iraqi forces taking back Tikrit rather than Shiite forces invading and conquering Tikrit, then that's a major difference just in the way that it's explained and the way it's understood compared to the truth and what's actually happening on the ground there, right?
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, which is what is the priority? Is the priority ridding Iraq of the Islamic State at any cost? Or is the priority maintaining a multi-sect country and a representative government? That right now, at least, neither one is possible, that the Iraqi forces simply cannot conduct an operation needed on their own. And the U.S. cannot concede that it is working in the U.S. And so we have this sort of opaque war in which alliances are being made but not being spoken about. Mm-hmm. The purposes are sort of different for each one of those countries. I think the U.S. priority is keeping Iraq intact. The Iranian purpose is to increase its influence in the region. And so when you say we don't really know, it's because everybody's sort of speaking in code, right, because this conflict has created so many strange bedfellows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now, let me ask you this. Do you know much about the Shiite militias working with Sunni tribal leaders? I saw some pictures and read one report that said that there are Sunni tribes who are happy to work with the Shia against the Islamic State right now. And I was thinking, you know, if they're powerful enough to really be a good partner with the Shiite militias, maybe they would be the ones who end up holding Tikrit rather than it being cleansed and the population replaced by Shiites.
That's right. I mean, that's the hope, that there is some sort of alliance, that the Sunnis that were seen as maybe fearing militias are saying, you know what, this is a better alternative, that it is worth making that alliance to rid our community of the Islamic State, that we don't want to live in the Islamic State. My own sense is that, frankly, if given the choice, the Sunnis don't want to live under either. They don't want to live under an Iraqi government in which militias have such a strong power, and they don't want to live under the Islamic State either. And so the question becomes, how long does this alliance hold out? You know, I think the concern about the ethnic cleansing is very real, but so far we haven't seen evidence of it. And I think there's an awareness by all sides that to begin to conduct that now threatens the state, threatens the government, and threatens the U.S. coalition, that the U.S.-led coalition will not stay intact if some of those Sunni Arab state partners start to see that. And so it's all very delicate right now, is how I would put it. And everybody's being delicate in their language and in their approach and even in their military tactics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very contradictory policies, it seems like, here between the Americans and the Iranians as they're working together. If the Americans really mean what they say about trying to hold the Iraqi state together, when the Iranian-backed factions, the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, have been very clear since 2003 that all they want to do is break off Shiistan. They want strong federalism, meaning let the Sunnis rot out in the sun with the worst part of Iraq, with the least amount of developed oil resources, and if they don't like it, tough. And if they could get the Americans to take Baghdad for them, then that would be nice. But otherwise, their agenda always was take Shiistan, not try to conquer all of, you know, Fallujah, Tikrit, Mosul, et cetera, right?
Well, what's kept Iraq intact, though, is that nobody can survive independently, that neither the Kurds nor the Sunnis nor the Shia can actually survive with an independent state. And so what's happened is this sort of breakup along sectarian lines, but no one has been pushing for the actual division of the state because nobody can sustain it. And so that's what we're seeing, the manifestation of that.
Well, I can see the Shia and the Kurds needing each other, but why do the Shia need the Sunnis?
Well, because first of all, there is oil in some of those areas, in Mosul, for example. And they don't need the instability of angering, if you will, their Sunni partners by cutting off a Sunni state. That creates its own complications. And the Kurds don't want that state broken up. And so that pushes them to not want to push for an independent state, if you will, and because the Kurds cannot survive independent without the resources of the central government. So all of those factors come into play.
Right. Yeah, very interesting. Then we got, at the same time, we got them trying to lure the Jordanians further in there to fight on the side of Iran. That should be interesting. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time again, Nancy. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Appreciate it. That's Nancy Youssef, y'all. She's at the Daily Beast. U.S. warplanes are helping Iran win in Iraq. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Daniel Scott here, man. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, man. One thing they don't warn you about is when you do a Kickstarter, you'll get 10,000 spam emails from every wannabe copycat Kickstarter in the world. Oh, you did a Kickstarter, huh? Maybe you want to do a Kickstarter over at our website, too. No, I don't. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, I had to let Nancy go early there because she has a deadline writing more stuff. Very important article here. At the Daily Beast again, U.S. warplanes helping Iran win. And this has been the case. You know, I asked Lande on the show, Jonathan Lande from McClatchy Newspapers, about the Supreme Islamic Council, who were the Iraqi traitors, some of the Iraqi traitors who fled to Iran when Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran back in 1980. And they lived in Iran throughout the Iran-Iraq War, throughout the Gulf War and Bill Clinton's blockade of death in the 1990s, and then they invaded Iraq on the heels of George W. Bush in 2003. And I went to ask Lande about that, and Lande said, hey, I was there when they came across the border. I saw him with my own eyes. He was there when Abdul Aziz al-Hakim and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq came across the border from Iran to take over the country, which makes George Bush and everyone who ever agreed with George Bush about that war the tool of the Ayatollah. The tiny little tool of Ayatollah Khomeini, whose plan it was to get the United States to get rid of Saddam Hussein for him, to reverse that Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan policy of supporting Iraq to contain Iran and their Shiite revolution. So, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Have you noticed that all the people who are the worst on wanting war with Iran are all the very same people who wanted to fight a war for them in Iraq? And in fact, were the ones who said, no, we can't leave. We're not done winning the war for Iran yet, derp. For years on end. Very same people. And, you know, it's amazing, actually. I got a tweet like this, so I'm repeating myself. Sorry, but if you look at some of the reporting over what's going on in Iraq now, it's basically impossible to talk about it without explaining a little bit of Sunni Shia division of who's who and what are they fighting over. And yet, if you go back to Iraq War II, from the years 2003 through 2009, they never told you, they never told you who was who. It's always, oh, the Iraqi people versus the terrorists. They never were honest. And so you really have people who paid attention, more or less, to the Iraq War, who've lived all the way through it, who still have no idea who's who. Who still have no idea that George Bush and the Republicans and every last one of their cheerleaders were actually the useful idiots of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Who have no idea that America fought a war for the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Not for the Iraqi people, for Iran's sock puppets in Iraq. You idiots. And so, here we are. With a brand new war, it's all about Sunni versus Shia, and they don't know what to do. Because all they can explain is, yeah, America and Iraq right now is fighting on the side of the Shia, and their Iranian friends against the Sunnis that America completely marginalized and drove into the arms of a bunch of terrorists in the first place. And so, ask yourself, though, self, How come the Iranians didn't say to the Americans, hey, you guys are our tiny little useful idiot tools. We're invading to Crete right now, and we would appreciate some air support. So get to it, servant. Why not? Why wouldn't they do that? Oh, that's because they don't trust the Americans. Even after George Bush fought a war for Iran for 8 years straight, they still don't trust them. And there's good reason why not to trust them. Like, for example, the Americans and their Israeli allies are working with Al-Qaeda in Syria. And when you're reading in Reuters, where they're coming right out and saying, yeah, maybe we need to go ahead and recruit the al-Nusra Front and start calling them moderates and use them to fight Bashar al-Assad, you can pretty much bet it's already happened. They've already decided to do this. And check out this article from the New York Times as just one example of how easily they float this. First of all, the article is about the deaths of some of the leaders of al-Qaeda in Syria. The deaths of, by high explosives, of some of the leaders of the al-Nusra Front. Well, who killed them? It doesn't say in the New York Times who killed them. But, of course, the answer is Bashar al-Assad killed them. Who's the enemy of al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria? Bashar al-Assad. The clean-shaven, three-piece suit-wearing, might-as-well-be European fascist dictator. Secular dictator of Syria. That's who killed them. But no, they would still have us believe, while America is nothing but the Assad, that is the Iranian sock puppet in Iraq, the Americans would still have us, and the Israelis and the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris, would still have us treat Assad as the enemy in Syria. Even though Bill Clinton and George Bush paid this guy to torture and kill jihadists for us. Obama's policy, and even though it seemed as though a year ago they were kind of switching back to Assad, apparently the politics in D.C. are still playing out here. And they're floating, and look how easily they float this in the New York Times. They quote some guy, Hania, a Jordanian expert on Islamic groups, says that the al-Nusra Front has long lacked internal cohesion. With some members sticking, did I drop the A out of that? Cohesion. With some, did I just call it H-A? Cohesion. With some members sticking to al-Qaeda's goal of attacking the West, while others prefer to focus on attacking Bashar al-Assad. Internal discussions on whether to declare an Islamic emirate to compete with ISIS or to cut ties with al-Qaeda in hopes of receiving more military aid have divided the group's fighters, although they band together in the face of common enemies. Point being, geez, if they would just cut ties with al-Qaeda, if they would just claim to no longer be loyal to al-Qaeda, eh, maybe they get some money. And, you know, let me go to the moon of Alabama, because they have another one about this here. I got a page down. Another Let's Ally with al-Nusra campaign. Oh, this reminds me. It was in Foreign Affairs. In the Council on Foreign Relations Journal, Foreign Affairs, they had a piece saying we should stop attacking al-Qaeda. They don't really say, yeah, they're actually our enemies, where the Islamic State has never attacked the United States. I mean, yeah, they killed some American journalists over there, but people had put themselves in a dangerous war zone. So far, they haven't attacked the United States. It's al-Qaeda that's Americans' enemies, but anyway, that doesn't matter. That doesn't have anything to do with it. As they write here at Moon of Alabama, in October 2013, a media campaign tried to sell Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's arm in Syria, as the good terrorists, worthy of Western support against the bad terrorists of the Islamic State. Other jihadist groups, like Ahrar al-Shams, were also seen by some as favorable allies. Qatar, the main sponsor of Jabhat al-Nusra, is now again trying to sell the al-Qaeda terrorists as the solution against the Islamic State everyone has been waiting for. This as more and more U.S.-sponsored moderate rebels defect toward al-Nusra. The new campaign started with a claim in a Reuters piece based solely on the words of one unreliable Syrian rebel and anonymous Qatari sources that Jabhat al-Nusra might loosen ties with Al-Qaeda Central in exchange for Qatari money and Western help. That means you. That means the money that they take out of your paycheck. Later, an official Jabhat al-Nusra paper only somewhat denied that. Two pieces by Western experts were launched with which both try to sell Al-Qaeda in Syria as the good side that deserves our support. These are not like earlier slightly hidden propaganda suggestions, but straight out arguments to ally with Al-Qaeda. One is by Dr. Roberts at the BBC, and then another is by a guy named Mendelssohn, an Israeli named Mendelssohn in Foreign Affairs, accepting Al-Qaeda, the enemy of the United States enemy. Treason. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Something tells me that The Onion used to be funny. Do you guys remember that? I think I read somewhere that they fired all their funny people because they accidentally hurt somebody's feelings. And where's even the satire in that? I don't even get it. Anyway. I used to be funny. Back way before any of you guys ever heard of me anyway. All right, well, whatever. Our next guest on the show today is our good friend Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter in Iraq War II, did absolutely heroic journalism from that disaster. Here he is writing for truthout.org. Domestic military expansion spreads through the U.S., ignites dissent. It was Spotlight, at least it was one of the viewpoints yesterday on antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Dar. How are you doing, man?
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Very important article that you wrote here. Very interesting stuff. And I think you probably have this beat all to yourself as well. So maybe we'll be, read more of you along these lines in the future, too. But this is, I think, primarily about the Navy and the expansion of the Navy's proving grounds and practicing grounds here in the United States. Why don't you break it down for us here?
Well, that's exactly right. And this basically is a result of some policies that came online during the Bush administration in 2007, where a domestic military training expansion was set in motion and then have been dramatically accelerated just a couple of years ago when the Obama administration announced the so-called Asia-Pacific pivot, where clearly getting ready for the multipolar world, which really we're now in with the rising of China and Russia, and U.S. military documents speak now very, very specifically towards preparing for war gaming with China. And so hence the Asia Pacific pivot. We've got to build up the Navy. We've got to start training like mad. And I link to a lot of these documents in the article. But in sum, what this has resulted to, I mean, even long before this happened, every single coastal state in the United States had very, very heavy active naval training exercises happening, but these are all being expanded, as is the training right now as part of this Asia Pacific pivot. And so what that's resulting in is a dramatic increase in electromagnetic warfare training, expansion in the training grounds, and it's also resulting in a major infringement on national forest lands, national parks, and even cities where people are living, where military buffer zones around bases, for example, are starting to infringe upon cities, and in some instances, the threat of eminent domain and this kind of thing. So literally, domestic citizens in the U.S. are now being encroached upon in various ways by this U.S. military domestic expansion.
All right. So now, the biggest controversy of all about this was Vieques down there in Puerto Rico, right? And now they ended up closing that one down back a few years ago, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. They did. They did. And so, but what's really interesting is that this is now happening in the U.S. And I think I'm glad you brought that up because that's a good example. Because, you know, as you and I know, and we've talked about in various ways over the years, you know, people here think, oh, well, this could never happen here. This is the United States. You know, that was in Puerto Rico. Okay. But it's not going to happen here, but it already is happening here. It's just a little bit less visible. I mean, they're already doing underwater sonar weapons testing, underwater ordnance explosions, live fire training, even right nearby certain communities across the U.S. I hyperlinked to a document in 2009 where, 2009 when several U.S. senators penned a letter to the Navy about their concern about upcoming naval expansion at that time, where the Navy admitted in their own environmental impact statement that as many as 11.7 million takes, which basically means death of a biological organism in nature, would happen over the course of a five-year permit during one of their expansions in just one of their 12 training ranges in the United States. And so that's the amount of damage that is happening. But since it's underwater, since it's off the coast, people can't see it directly. So it's not as blatant as Vieques, where they're just dropping bombs right near, you know, where people live. But it is already happening. And this is something that I hope that this article would start to make people aware of.
Right. Now, it's funny here about the National Forest. You have this great quote about the National Forests from this activist here about how they're basically just military property. The National Forests are basically up for grabs for the most violent and destructive part of the government to go running around and training and doing whatever they want, huh?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And yeah, you're referencing Carol Miller. She's an activist in New Mexico who founded a nonprofit called the Peaceful Skies Coalition. And she founded it because several years ago, basically the Air Force showed up right next to her community and said, hey, we're going to put a realistic bombing initiative range right next to your community. And so all hell broke loose, and her and a lot of her friends started protesting, and they managed to keep it from happening. And it was she who went on to say, you know, she started doing research and seeing, hey, this isn't happening just here in New Mexico. It's happening all across the country. And it's not just the Air Force. It's the Navy and it's other branches of the military too. And she told me that look, she said, we have either had, are having, or will have military training in every single national force in the country. And then she's the one that went on to say, we don't really have public lands in the United States. We have military lands.
Military lands. Yep. And, you know, no surprise really, but tell me about Whidbey Island over there off the coast of Washington State, right there near the Canadian border. There's a Navy air base located there, right?
Right. There's a naval air station there. It's right in Puget Sound. So it's probably about 25, 30 miles northwest of Seattle as the crow flies, to give folks an idea where it's located. And as you said, it's also very, very close to the Canadian border. And it's already a fairly sizable naval air station. And they have a whole lot of the F-18 Growler jets based there. This is the loudest aircraft ever produced on the planet. And it's actually a carrier-based jet, but they're there training as part of this Asia-Pacific pivot. And the plan is to bring in a whole lot more Growler jets so that they can start electromagnetic warfare training out on the Western Olympic Peninsula in Olympic National Forest. And so that's really what kind of torched off this article for me. I mean, it is fairly close to where I live. That's how it came to my attention. And people here just started going crazy, basically. Say, hey, look, we don't want this to happen. And so a lot of people have gotten involved starting to fight it. There are possible lawsuits in the works against the Navy for a lot of violations they've done in their environmental impact statement and some of the other bureaucratic hoops they have to jump through to make this happen. But, you know, I started digging, and basically there's even outcry from the Canadian side, a Canadian Minister of Parliament named Elizabeth May, who's also the head of the Green Party up there, actually sent a letter to Canada's U.S. ambassador, Bruce Hayman, expressing her direct concerns over sonic booms that have been happening across the skies over her constituents' heads, loud enough that it's literally knocking people's rattling people's windows and knocking their cookware off shelves and things like this. And she's not the only one. Another minister of parliament also submitted a letter, and I received several quotes from people living over there in Victoria and other parts around British Columbia saying, look, we're regularly being subjected to sonic booms. It's very, very unsettling. And this has got to be a violation of some kind of treaty. So there's a lot of outcry happening up here now. You know, that's why I mentioned the dissent bit and go into that in the article, over what's happening. And then also over a really, really bellicose response from the Navy.
Right. Now, I want to talk more about the activism and the pushback against the activism when we get back from this break. Music's about to start playing here in just a second. But so let me remind the good folks, you're listening to Dar Jamail. He's the author of this new one at truthout.org, Domestic Military Expansion Spreads Through the U.S., Ignites Dissent. And I think you guys will be shocked but not surprised to hear about the military pushback against the American citizens, you know, we the people, who would take exception to the Navy's plans for their private property. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's FFF.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dar Jamail. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone. And here he is. Well, he's covering militarism and environmentalism at the same damn time here with this piece in Truth Out. Domestic military expansion spreads throughout the U.S., ignites dissent. So let's talk, first of all, I want to get into all the activism and the military pushback and all that. But give us a good rundown on the harm here, Dar, for wildlife, when it comes to people's private property rights, et cetera, as best you can.
Wow, where to start? Well, starting with human harm, certainly I've written a couple of articles in the past about the impacts of just the electromagnetic warfare training itself, because I interviewed an expert, actually a professor emeritus, on the subject of biological response to low-level electromagnetic radiation, a guy out of Washington State University. And he talked about how even extremely low levels of electromagnetic radiation, I mean, we're not even talking about beginning to get in the ballpark of the intense levels that the Navy will be using during their trainings and certainly during warfare, but even the extremely low levels, there's literally dozens of peer-reviewed studies that show they increase the risk of cancer. They cause childhood leukemia. They're very dangerous for pregnant women, very dangerous for young people and older people, et cetera, et cetera. And I went on to go on and cite and actually link to several reports verifying this, one by the Navy itself, which I found very interesting, another one by the U.S. Air Force itself, and then another one by NASA. So it's very, very clear. You look at these reports, you look at the number of peer-reviewed studies and ongoing contemporary peer-reviewed studies, and it is irrefutable that even low-grade electromagnetic warfare training is going to be very, very dangerous to humans.
Well, what exactly do you mean by that? You're using Aegis radar or...
Well, they have ground-based emitters, at least just with the program they're looking at out here, where they would put 14 RV-sized ground-based emitters, basically these big antenna that they can drive around on the ground, put them in various locations around the national forest, which they admit themselves that, well, the Navy claims that they're not harmful because they say, look, a human would have to stand nearby these ground-based emitters for 15 minutes, at which point their eyeballs would melt. but no human being's going to stand near these emitters for 15 minutes because we're not going to let them. So that's basically their response. Mm-hmm. And then the planes would, of course, fly over and be obviously using their radars to locate these. And then the Navy claims they wouldn't be doing radar jamming and that kind of thing. But, you know, talking to some folks in the military I know said, no, absolutely, they're going to be doing it because the Navy itself says we train as we fight. They want to have the most realistic training scenarios they can. That's why I mentioned earlier the use of ordnance and live fire and et cetera, et cetera. So that's the level that we would be talking about. But even in the Navy's own environmental impact statements, they kind of give these sleight of hands where it is clear by the example I just gave that even standing nearby one of their emitters for a few minutes is clearly going to cause biological harm. So that's just one example on the human side. And then just quickly on the wildlife side, mm-hmm. for example, again, just using their electromagnetic warfare training out here, a billion, according to the Audubon Society, 1 billion birds use that area as a migratory pathway. And there's numerous studies also out there, also contemporary, that show that even low level electromagnetic radiation is going to have a deleterious impact on a bird's bionavigational ability. So, you know, there's a billion birds right there that are going to be affected just by that. I cite numerous other studies that show and even recent news reports showing their underground sonar testing and underground weapons training as well is killing whales and dolphins. There's been a lot of whale and dolphin kills off of the coast of California, some off of Oregon. This is all in direct response to Navy sonar trainings. So those are just a couple of short examples.
Right. And yeah, and that's really important when you're talking about messing up the entire food chain here. And I guess, you know, these are small parts of it, but, mass damage can be done all at one time. If you have whatever, however many dozens of dead beached whales, who knows what else happened to the rest of the wildlife under the sea that got zapped with the same sonar that zapped them, but seems pretty damn destructive on its face anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and these are just a few examples. And, you know, to give, you know, just to kind of circle back around to what I mentioned earlier, I mean, just in one of their environmental impact statements while they were applying for a permit for more training back in 2007, even the Navy itself estimated 11.7 million takes, which means dead wildlife critters, during 1 5-year permit for one permit in one range. And there's at least 12 ranges that we know of.
All right, now, sorry we're short on time. You know how it goes with these segments. But tell us real quickly about the people doing something about this and what the Navy is doing back to them for trying.
Well, there are several groups now, even a lot of the leading things like National Resource Defense Council, the Sierra Club, a lot of other national wildlife protection groups like Animal Legal Defense Fund, Animal Welfare Institute, Center for Biological Diversity, and a lot of activist groups that are involved in trying to push back and stop them. And when they've done this, so certainly with the activist groups, the Navy has actually brought out trolls, and a lot of their own pilots up here have been posting very, very negative and oftentimes threatening comments to their websites that they set up. Things like, hey, how about we just strap one of you guys to one of our growlers next time we go to war against ISIS and you can see how that feels. And then, you know, one quote I have pulled up in front of me, I think it's worth reading in full just to give people an idea of the bellicose response. It was via an email from a Navy pilot to one of the activist websites just in this past January. And he said, I assure you that you will be long gone before the growlers here are. Service life of the growlers is 40 to 45 years. And man, we just built some beautiful new facilities at NAS Whidbey. That's the Naval Air Station, Whidbey Island. Washington is the absolute best state for military airspace, wide open skies and unpopulated areas. You are not important. In fact, you scumbags are completely expendable.
Yeah, absolutely. That's because, like it says in the Constitution, we, the government, allow you people to exist at our pleasure so that we can tax you and build jets with your money so we can kill Arabs with it. That's what it says right there in the preamble. And and all of us are expendable because the government comes first before the citizens of this United States, right?
Right, exactly. Things are just a little bit topsy-turvy. Clearly.
You got to read between the lines a little bit, but it's pretty much right in there.
Yeah. Clearly, that's what's happening. Yeah,
that's clearly their attitude. You know, wherever would we be without the Navy here to protect us from the terrorists? Give me a break.
Right. Yeah.
Buy them another $20 billion submarine.
I know. It's really out of control. But I hope that people pay attention to this because it is happening. It's happening across the country. And don't wait until it's right up against your community, because if it's not there now, it's coming your way.
Absolutely. Great work, as always, Dar. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
All right, y'all. That's the great Dar Jamail. He's at truthout.org. Domestic military expansion spreads through the U.S., ignites dissent. It's a really good piece. Please go and read it. We'll be right back with Grant Smith in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Grant F. Smith. He wrote a whole bunch of books. The latest one is called Divert. It's about the Israelis stealing American weapons-grade uranium. Well, you know how they like to steal things, the Israelis. Anyway, he runs the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP, IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org. And, hey, they're putting on a special conference with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. This one is called the Israel Lobby. Is it good for the U.S.? Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Grant?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here. So, April the 10th, what day of the week is that?
Oh, that falls on a Friday. So the All next right. day you can go to the National Cherry Blossom Parade, the festival parade. But the most important thing is the 8-5 action at the National Press Club Ballroom. And that's where we're having the event.
Okay, great. Now, is this going to be a gigantic shindig like we had a year ago?
It is. Hopefully, I think we've got it structured so that people don't have to speak 600 words a minute. There's a little bit more slack in the program, but it's every bit as big and important, and a whole new raft of speakers, a couple of repeats. And we're really excited and hoping people come. It's a really great event, all day, lunch included, breakneck action.
Great. I want to go.
Well, you're going to have to save up $75, right. Get here, and, we'll keep a slot open for you. You're a journalist. You get in free. Students and journalists get to come free. So
I don't have a press pass.
Okay.
I guess
you can just make one up.
There you go.
Just photocopy your picture onto a press. Yeah, we're accepting all comers in terms of media. Our media list is quite long, and people can go to the website IsraelLobbyUS.org, request press credentials, and also students. So we've got a lot from American University, George Washington, a lot of locals. And some from, the Midwest and West Coast as well. So shaping up. It'll be the crowd will be a nice mix of old hands, neophytes, young, old, middle. So that's what we've always hoped for, is just to get a really good crowd and not necessarily people who just follow the issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us some names? Who's already accepted invitations to speak there?
Sure. Should I start with the ones that are always on your show, or should I not say?
Yeah, whatever order you think
Porter.
Is best.
Okay. Well, Gareth Porter's coming, and that's good because he can give an update on the manufacturing crisis, and he always does a good job of that, and we're hoping to get some good information from him. MJ Rosenberg, who's been on your show quite a bit, he's coming, and he's going to talk a little bit about his experience and working at APAC and his observations of the organization since. So that should be very exciting. We've got Richard Falk, who was a UN High Commissioner looking at human rights in the occupied territories, is coming. He was targeted by UN Watch, so he's going to talk a little bit about what it's like trying to do a job like that while you're under a constant campaign to fire you. Congressmen Paul Findlay and Mick Rahal are going to be there, and they're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to work in Congress, again, under pressure from various pro-Israel organizations, including AIPAC, and trying to pass legislation in that environment. Seth Morrison, who's worked at a lot of different organizations that one can consider to be Israel lobbying type organizations, like the Jewish National Fund, J Street, and now he's at JVP, is going to be there and talk a little bit about what sort of broken promises that these organizations drove him out and made him become a BDS campaigner with JVP. Miko Peled, who's the son of a general, is going to talk about his experience and transformation and getting to know the issue from all over the world. He's an Israeli now based in California. Paul Pilar, who was there last year, he's a former high CIA official. He's going to hopefully do the same thing he did last year, which is deconstruct the AIPAC agenda for this and next year, and Netanyahu's speech and other observations that he has. He's always been a keen observer of that sort of thing. Alice Rothschild, who's a doctor, is going to talk about humanitarian concerns in the Middle East. Ahmad Saladin is going to be there. He's a guy who's an activist and movie producer. He's going to talk a little bit about some of his work and how younger people on campus are organizing and looking at what's going on in the region. Jack Shaheen, who's got a comprehensive study of how Arabs and Muslims are depicted in U.S. media and how that contributes to the overall feeling about them in politics and in just regular society. Dima Khalidi's coming. She's with a legal support firm of lawyers that do all sorts of, protection of free speech on campus and other legal rights for people who are kind of under the gun now. Amani Al-Khatare, who's coming, she's the editor-in-chief of MuslimGirl.net, which is a blog talking about stereotypes of Muslim women and her activism and targeting. And Jeff Langford, who's a radio guy out in California and a photojournalist, is going to be talking about the Anti-Defamation League campaign against him and some anti-apartheid activists and how they won a legal settlement against that organization, and kind of talk about the tactics then and now of that particular organization. So it's Gideon Levy from Haaretz. He's a leading journalist.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he's coming. He wrote a book called The Punishment of Gaza, and he does a lot of information about the Israeli side and the Palestinian side in peace negotiations. So it's a really interesting group of people. Nobody's getting a script to read, so it's not going to be like going to an AIPAC conference where people are reading teleprompters and making statements. There will be more genuine debate and probably disagreements, but that's good. As far as I know, it's the only conference being organized to really look at the lobby, how big it is, what it's doing. And, of course, I'll be speaking about that as well, since it's my intense focus as well, research focus. So it should be pretty good. And then there are also some new ads in terms of moderators. Asghi Mohammed, who's a local radio person, WPFW, is going to be moderating some panels. And we have some other moderators who we're not totally sure of yet, but who should be quite interesting contributions to keeping the show going and doing informed moderation of the panels.
Cool. Man, that sounds really great. You know, there's only one omission that's kind of glaring here, it sounds like to me, Grant. Maybe you just skipped over it, or maybe I wasn't paying attention. But isn't someone going to give a talk about how important Palestine was to Osama bin Laden and Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib, the guys that knocked our towers down, and how we wouldn't even be in this mess if it wasn't for the Israel lobby convincing the U.S. government to pay for all their sins against the people of Palestine and southern Lebanon? And now the music's playing, and I'll have to get your answer to that awesome question.
The music's playing.
So we got to go to this break. But when we get back, we'll be talking more with Grant F. Smith, author of Divert and leader of IRMEP, IRMEP.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show here. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Grant F. Smith. Did I already say that? I'm talking with Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. And really what he does is he files Freedom of Information Act papers all damn day, and including SUSM, if he has to get the paperwork to document Israeli crimes in the United States. Not crimes of Israelis, but crimes of the Israeli government in this country. And, yeah, overall, the power of the Israel lobby, licit and illicit, but primarily specializing in the laws they break. And so we're talking about this new thing they're putting on. It's on Friday, April the 10th, at the National Press Club, the Israel lobby. Is it good for the U.S.? Now, it's a kind of a narrow question. It's not, the question isn't just entirely, you know, about Israel. It's about the Israel lobby in the U.S., but that's a pretty pretty broad list of speakers that you already named there. But it seems to me like, I don't know, maybe the first talk should be given by someone who might be willing to explain the importance of America's support for Israel in causing terrorist blowback against the United States. After all, at least according to the official story, that's why Sirhan Sirhan killed RFK back in 1968, and it's sure as hell why Mohammed Atta joined al-Qaeda. It's in the book Perfect Soldiers by Terry McDermott. He would do nothing but sit around his apartment in Hamburg all day long talking about how Americans must die for what Israel did in Palestine and in Lebanon that day. And that sounds crazy to Americans, maybe, because they don't understand that every bullet Israel fires is an American bullet. Every rifle they shoot is an American rifle. Every plane, every helicopter, all of that comes from the United States of America. And it was, of course, in bin Laden's fatwas of 96 and 98, his interviews with ABC News and CNN. I'm going to kill you because you keep paying the Israelis to keep killing Palestinian babies. That was what he said in the first place. And it seems like, the only reason I'm going on and on is for the same reason you want to have all these guys speak at this thing, is because these are the facts the American people don't really know. And we're left to base our conclusions about what it is that we would have our government do on erroneous, something, clearly I'm plagiarizing Bill Hicks here, but you understand my point. Nobody ever discusses the truth of this, that it's not our support for Israel being a bunch of really nice guys and minding their own business all day. It's American support for Israeli war crimes against people's tiny, helpless babies.
No, that's a good point. And we, in some of the iterations of the program, wanted to have kind of at least an Iraq to Iran continuum and try and mention some of the history there. You're probably the only guy, though, who speaks and reminds us of all of this on a constructive basis. So I'm going to take that under advisement because you're right. It is a very, very important piece of this. Nobody does know about that. Nobody could rattle off the dates, the motivations, the statements. And so you're right. That's missing. But hey, we've got a month still, and believe me, we're still working on this. So observation accepted.
Yeah, there you go. Well, good. I hope it makes a little bit of a difference because to me, you know, I don't know, man. I'm always trying to figure out what are the details that the people don't know that maybe if they did, they'd look at things a little bit different. Like, for example,
Yeah. Did
you know that Palestine's not the country next door? It's occupied territory under a foreign government's martial law for the past 50 years. And people go, oh, actually, no, I didn't know that. Maybe I should look into it just a little bit. That kind of thing. It seems like, you know, there are a lot of people, so-called experts, who claim that, oh, bin Laden was Johnny-come-lately to the Palestine issue, and he only glommed onto that later to try to get some more support. That's just not true. And that was what he complained about from, I don't know, at least 1996 on, I think publicly even probably before that, that American support for Israel was right up there with the occupation of the Arabian Desert and the bombing and blockading of Iraq, and reasons why Al-Qaeda needs to attack the United States.
Yeah. No, that's spot on. And you're right. That's outside the narrative. And that is not the kind of thing that's ever brought up. There's always a starting point, just like, you know, the lobby's starting point is always Israel's this great strategic asset, but they'll never explain why.
Right.
in terms of blowback, you don't even get this. So you're right. That is something that needs to be explored. And
it's not much in dispute either. I mean, you got bin Laden's own words, but you also have the very legitimate journalism of people like Lawrence Wright and Terry McDermott who have explained this as well, you know?
Well, it's even in the 9/11 Commission's report. But again, the number of people who can access all of that and have it in hand and put it in any sort of sensible order to explain all this is of course, I know you can do it, but nobody else can. So that is a very good point, and that is that's a missing piece. But I would tend to have that, you know, some of the first things that we're doing as we put this into a chronology is just explain, you know, what is the lobby and where did it come from, and try and go through some of the basics first, and then finally get into the nitty gritty. What's it doing to Congress, and you know, why is it moving us into this intense focus on Iran and that sort of thing? But
well, yeah, I'll tell you what the second half of my speech would be is why is America supporting the jihad in Syria right now? When it would seem to be directly contrary to our interests. They're even talking about renaming the al-Nusra Front a bunch of moderates so we can give them some more guns.
Yeah, I've noticed you've been focusing on that in some of the recent shows, and that is a very good point. So, well, we're going to buff this thing up, and we've got some more conference committee meetings. So,
cool.
No, this is... we've had a lot of really good advice from a lot of people who'll be named and unnamed at this thing, and everyone's got an idea about what it needs to cover. And
well, that's I'm sure that's true. I'm sure I'm not the brightest of those coming up with better ideas either. But anyway.
No, you are. You are. Believe me, you are. And
I talked with Phil Giraldi on the show yesterday, and we were talking about that famous quote from Steve Rosen about the lobby works best in the dark as a night flower and it shrivels when exposed to sunlight. And I wonder whether you think that things are really changing in Washington, D.C., where it used to just go completely unremarked outside of the most, you know, kind of wonky insider circles, that Israel even has any influence in Washington, D.C. over American policy whatsoever. It's just not the kind of thing that Americans usually ever hear about. And I wonder whether you think that's really changing.
Oh, I think it's changing a lot. And, you know, MJ Rosenberg, he was the guy who was told that. And so I hope he goes into that when he covers it. But they're just so much more in your face now. I mean, really, all the full-page ads in the New York Times condemning Obama and all these full-page ads saying people need to go and hear Netanyahu. You know, it's to the extent that they used to be a little bit more night flower-ish, there are now so many organizations and a great deal of real competition between organizations that they don't seem to care, at least the new ones, about having a dust up and maybe, you know, creating problems for themselves by being so outspoken and insistent. I mean, it's for an organization like this new one that you've talked about a little bit, the Israeli American Council, to get out there and be talking about buying newspapers and putting more messages out and how much they're going to spend on the presidential elections. I mean, they're really becoming so noisy and out front and doing things that so many people find objectionable that, you know, it's not smart, but it is having a very good effect in terms of transparency. I mean, people really are starting to sit up and notice. And I get messages from people all the time who I don't think follow this, but they're following it. And they're just, you know, they're out in heartland America, and they're suddenly beginning to see who's posting all of these massive campaigns and really trying to saturate the media with all these messages. And they're starting to say, wow, this isn't good.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I hope this conference does that as well. I hope that by really having a conference not focused on effect but on cause, these are the organizations, this is what they're doing, this is why Americans are so underinformed about this, this is why, you know, X number think that Iran already has nuclear weapons, blah, blah, blah. People really, really start to pay attention and insist on not having so much. I mean, I think it's fairly telling that you probably already covered this, but the White House poll on their page, a petition has been asking for Logan Act prosecutions for all of these senators who, you know, people don't know about that. And yet suddenly 125,000 people are signing a pretty esoteric petition on Middle East policy and standing up and taking notice within days. And so that's also really interesting. It's just another example that people are paying attention. But anyway, people really need to come to this conference if they can. We'll find a way to get you a seat. It's a great venue. The time of year is perfect, and they can go to IsraelLobbyUS.org and see the speakers. And in a few more days, we're going to release the program. So hopefully we'll have it totally finished and fill all the gaps.
Okay, great. And again, that's IsraelLobbyUS.org, IsraelLobbyUS.org for this upcoming conference. The Israel Lobby, is it good for the U.S.? That's Friday, April the 10th. At the National Press Club. Thanks, Grant.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. And that's it for the show today, y'all. See you tomorrow.